After so much energy, you can relax. A rabbi sometimes surprises himself. When I decided to talk about this big blue book this morning, I instinctively entitled this talk the New Prayer Book. And then I opened up the title page and I realized that it had been published in 1975, which only goes to show how quickly time flies. But for us, it's a new book. We haven't used the Gates of Prayer very often. We've used it for the festivals, Sukkot, Pesach. We've used it occasionally here on Sunday mornings. I'd like to explain to you in part today why we haven't used it more. I'd like to explain to you why we're going to use it somewhat more and make you a little bit familiar with its purpose, its strengths, its weaknesses, and what it says about liberal Judaism in the 1970s and 80s. If you look at the spine of the book, you'll see that it's called the New Union Prayer Book. Now that's a title which is designed to put it in a direct line with the familiar little, much smaller prayer book which we've used since 1896 when it was first published. But in point of fact, though the theme of continuity is a very important one, this is not a revision. The Union Prayer Book was revised a number of times and re-edited. But as you can see, in size and shape, in structure, in many ways, a new entity. And it speaks of us in our dress of the late 20th century, as the Union Prayer Book did of liberal Judaism in the first part of this century. On the front cover and the back cover, you'll see the title Gates of Prayer and Sha'arei Tefillah, which is simply the Hebrew translation. It's obviously by this name that this prayer book will be known. Sha'arei, the word's an interesting one. It means gates. It has another meaning. In about 1460, when the first Hebrew books were published, that is, the first books that were printed were published, an enterprising editor, seeking to find something to do with a title page, put all the information that he wanted to put within a gate. He took what he thought were a design of the columns of Solomon's temple, the portico of the temple, and he printed these as a design on the page, a gate design, and printed the name of his book and various bits of information about it within the design. And so ever since, the frontispiece of a Hebrew book has been called a sha'ar, and it has two meanings. That is, it is the gate through which we pass into the book, and it is a reference to a line from the 118th Psalm, which says, Zeh ha-sha'ar l'adonai v'atzadikin yavo'u ba. This is the gate of the Lord, and the righteous shall enter into it. That is, it is the promise that what you find within is authentically Jewish, has value, as meaning for the reader. And so the sense of the gate is not an inappropriate one for this title. But I confess I'm not as happy with the word prayer. Not that I do not believe in prayer, obviously. But a worship service is much more than prayer. Prayer is spontaneous. Prayer is private. Prayer is the outpouring of our heart in a moment of great joy, in a moment of great tension, in a moment of great fear, in a moment of great need. Abe Lincoln used to say that he sometimes found himself down on his knees because he had no place else to go. That's what prayer is. You can't pray with another's words. Prayer is disingenuous. That is, it's yourself, revealing yourself, your need at the moment. You can't schedule prayer. You don't need a book for prayer. You don't need a congregation for prayer. No one has to teach you to pray. You pray in your native language instinctively, sometimes in no language at all. It's simply a feeling. And so The sense that this is a prayer book, to a certain degree, I think is misleading. Obviously, we often pray at services, but as often we don't. We participate in a Jewish moment. We touch again memories of people we have loved, of traditions that we love. We sense again the force, the thrust of Jewish history, but we don't always pray. Sometimes we do, sometimes the music, the melodies, the meanings unlock our hearts, but not always. And many of the problems I have had over the years trying to make people understand what a service is all about come because of their association of prayer and worship. But Rabbi, I came and I sat and I listened and I didn't pray. I came and I sat and I counted the bricks. I came and I sat and I listened to the music, but I didn't pray. I can't be a parrot. A prayer has to be my own words, and of course they're right. Now there's another technical term in Hebrew, which is called avodah. Avodah means religious practice. It was used first to describe the forms of practice as they were in the temple in Jerusalem. Sacrifices were called avodah. It comes from a Hebrew root which means work. It's religious practice. The rabbi said that there are three basic disciplines which a Jew is obliged to fulfill. Torah, study, the study of the tradition and the moral implications of the tradition. Avodah, religious practice. And gemilut chasadim, that is the doing of justice and of deeds of sense that are sensitive and kindly. I would have preferred had they called this the sha'arei avodah, that is the gates, the script, which shows us how to engage in worship. Worship does not suggest petition. It doesn't suggest the outpouring of the soul, the overheated outpouring of the soul. It suggests a quieter feeling and a more congregational moment. It suggests also what this book really is. For this book is simply a script. It's like a play in that sense. You can read a play. You don't have to see a play produced. You can read it, your imagination works itself around the dialogue. You imagine what the play might feel like, you sense its meaning. There are those who have taken our prayer books, keep them by their bedside, read from them from time to time. You don't need public worship to benefit from a book such as this. But the book is designed as a script, which given architecture, given music, given lighting, given some thought by those who are responsible for creating the happening, the moment, given the willingness to involve yourself as a congregation in the moment, it becomes something very special. It becomes something which is special to that place and that time and that music and that moment. And that's what a prayer book allows us to do. It provides us a script which consists of many of the great poems and psalms of the past, of many of the great moments and ceremonies and rituals which our tradition has created. And allows us to organize these, to schedule these, and to participate for a part of our lives, a small part of our lives, but a very significant part of our lives, in a moment which is entirely within the Jewish tradition. Now, to say this, as I would suggest to you, part of the key to understanding why there is a new prayer book, why it is that during the 1970s, the Reform Movement set about to create this book. If you look at the table of contents, which are right in the beginning of, right behind the title page, and you compare it in your mind's eye to the text which we've used for lo these many years, you'll notice that what you can feel is in fact true, that the book is twice as long, twice the size, more than twice as heavy than the Union Prayer Book, and includes any number of themes that were not in, and selections which were not in the original Union Prayer Book. There is, for instance, a Havdalah service, not in one but two, the service for the separation between the Sabbath and the work week, not simply a Friday service, but a Saturday afternoon service. There is a service for the for various moments that were Yom Ha'atzma'ut, which is the day which celebrates the independence of the State of Israel. There's a service for a memorial for the Holocaust. themes which obviously did not exist in the older prayer book. There's also in the back of the book a collection of some 70 songs and hymns which can be sung as part of worship. We're in much more of an atmosphere of congregational participation. And you'll notice as we went through the service today, there were none of those rubrics, those directions which we used to see, rabbi, congregation. The lines were simply printed, one's in Roman type, one in italic type, and the congregation could organize these as they wished. This book also says something about our own Hebraic illiteracy. At the very end of the very last thing in the index is a transliteration of recurring passages. There's some 26 of the familiar formula prayers which are transliterated, that is written in English, the English alphabet, so that you can form the Hebrew sounds. When the Union Prayer Book was written, it was still assumed that Jews could read Hebrew, and if they didn't read Hebrew, they would never have admitted it. And now there's, in a sense, the open admission that many in our congregations need this kind of pony, this kind of help, to participate easily in the service. Why, given the richness which is apparent in just from looking at the table of contents, why, given the fact that there are here 10 Friday night services, and 6 Saturday morning services, and 5 Torah services, and 4 services with for the conclusion of the service, the Aleinu, and 12 or 14 readings before the Kaddish, why, given the richness of this worship book, has not our congregation moved to use it more often than we have? That too helps us to understand, the answer to this helps us to understand the nature of our times and the changes that have taken place in our times. When the Union Prayer Book was put together originally, the late Friday evening service was still a radical reform. Very few congregations had it. The major service was a Saturday morning, a Shabbat morning service, and many, many congregations had this kind of service, a daily service on Sunday, which was a short worship service and a lecture. And the Union Prayer Book's weekday services, there are 4 of them, they are thematic, they are full, you're familiar, well familiar with them, and they fit the needs of this particular service. When they came to putting together this book, the late Friday evening service was a fixture in almost all congregations, and therefore 10 separate services thematically arranged, full and rich, with all kinds of ceremony and custom appropriate to them. 6 Saturday morning services, and the weekday service was written in terms of what a weekday service is used for primarily when it is used by Reform congregations. And that is, there are congregations which have a daily minyan, have a daily morning or evening service, largely attended by a few people who come, the more observant of the congregation, who come because they want to say Kaddish for someone who has died for whom they are to say Kaddish. And so the weekday services, as you saw this morning, tend to be fairly short. They're somewhat shorter than the ones in the Union Prayer Book. They tend to be much more Hebraic, that is much more structured towards the tradition. And they tend not to have the variety which we were able to find in the Union Prayer Book. On the other, there's only one service, interestingly, for the weekday, which is simply a morning service. The others, as you saw, sometimes have lines down the middle of the page so that you can use the morning, a liturgy for the morning or the liturgy for the evening off of the same service. This prayer book then, or worship book, was compiled for American Judaism as it is, as it finds itself in the mid or late 20th century. And almost all the themes which we would expect to find there are there. Women's liberation. The old prayer read, our God and God of our fathers, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The new prayer book says, our God and God of our fathers and our mothers, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, God of Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. It's a lot of names, but everybody got in the act. In the, most people have tended to see the new Gates of Prayer because of its heft, because of its richness, as essentially a return to tradition. And if you'd looked at the page just before the morning service, which we used, you would have seen that there is actually a service there for putting on tallit and tefillin, the prayer shawl and the phylacteries, which a traditional male Jew puts on each morning. There's much that is traditional in this prayer book, and there's much more color. But also, there's a statement of the fact that our movement has lost its direction. That's less obvious. When the Union Prayer Book was compiled, liberal Judaism had a philosophy. Its philosophy was liberal. Its philosophy was optimistic. Its philosophy was largely social action-oriented. It believed that the mind of man, coupled with the will and coupled with faith in God, could join hands with the minds and wills of people of many faiths and reasonably work together to create a new world, a better world, the messianic world. It was optimistic, it was rational, it was clear, it believed deeply in reason and the powers of human reason. As the 20th century progressed, and it's been a tragic century, we lost much of that optimism, we lost much of that faith in the mind. The mind came more and more to be the kinds of Rand Corporation people who compute how many will die in a first atomic strike. We began to talk more of faith. We began to talk more of the spiritual, the left side of the brain. And all of that, that emphasis on feeling rather than on reason, is in this text. But more than that, we find within it the unresolved position which we are. That is, no single new philosophic or theological position is taken over from what was before. Instead of that, we have those among us who are rationalists and those of us who are existentialists and those among us who are positivists and those among us who are naturalists. And we even have among us those who are obviously who are humanists, who believe in man and the potential of man, that we talk of the divine within man, but really mean simply the capacity of the human being for growth. All that somehow is reflected here. And there's a very, very strange service in the Gates of Prayer to which I'd like to call your attention. You've turned to page 210. The sixth of the 10 services for Friday night, you'll find a very interesting thing. I'm sorry, it begins on page 204. We have a service which starts with the lighting of Shabbos lights. It talks of Sabbath on page. It welcomes with the Sabbath, which is additional L'chod Dodi, the come bride of the Sabbath, we welcome you. If you turn to page 208, you'll see the familiar Baruch Hu, praise of the Lord, to whom all praise is due. But notice, in the middle of 208, the Baruch Hu is not translated. And then the next prayer, which starts, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, praised art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, by whose will the evening falls. When the translation is there, the translation says simply, there was silence, there was chaos, there was a voice, and so on. If you turn over to the next page, you'll see that the Shema is printed, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, but not translated. V'ahavta, that thou shalt love the Lord, the God, is printed, but not translated. And the English text never once in this service mentions the name of God. It's something of a charade. God is mentioned in Hebrew again and again and again. But in the English text, God is never mentioned. And this was written as a what they called equivocal service, that is, a service that could have many meanings and would not be found objectionable by those who no longer have faith in God. Now, what such a service is doing in the Jewish prayer book, I'm not quite sure. I don't know why anyone assumed that God wouldn't recognize himself being addressed in Hebrew if he's not addressed in the English. And I'm not quite sure what was being attempted here, because this seems to me very little different than what we find sometimes apostates from Judaism doing. That is, once they have converted Christianity, creating a little synagogue where they have Hebrew prayers and English prayers and have many of the traditional rituals, they simply add a prayer about Jesus to the service which they have created. It seems to me that liberal Judaism must always be responsive to the questions, the search, and must recognize that all of us have moments of doubt. None of us come to faith whole, and when we have faith, we often doubt it. But we must also recognize that the statement which is made by worship should be a statement of faith. This is the goal towards which we are hoping and helping people to grow. Understanding of the nature of God, understanding what faith in God can mean, and not to create a prayer book which appeals to the least common denominator among us. But interestingly, the service is here. Very few people notice what it really is, and they have the feeling that this is the most conservative of all of the prayer books which liberal Judaism has ever created. It is conservative, but it's also in this way very radical. The service, the prayer book itself then reflects us at this moment in time. You'll notice that the choreography, that is the way in which a congregation and the community respond to the worship, differs from what has been before, and is in a sense more traditional. We rise, we have risen over this century here at the temple only for the declaration of faith and for the sanctification. Now the congregation rises from the call to worship through the Shema, through the statement of faith, which is the way it's done in a traditional synagogue, and they rise again for the Amidah, the prayer said standing, which in our this prayer book is called Tefillah. These are the petitional prayers. These prayers were, to a certain degree, downplayed when the Union Prayer Book was written, because the bulk of them deal with messianism. The bulk of them deal with a promise at the end of time, and that promise in Judaism was largely a promise of land, return to the land, the end of exile, the reestablishment of the cult in the Temple of Jerusalem. And in the late 19th century and most of the 20th century, liberal Jews wanted to be in this Jerusalem and not in the one that was then in Palestine. And so they downplayed the Amidah. But this service book, this worship book, as Jews are today, all of us, is much more one that is at ease with the sense of peoplehood, the sense of nationhood. Hatikva is among the hymns that is presented in the hymn section of the book. It is happy with the theme of return to the land. Israel exists. It speaks openly and easily and often of the end of the exile, the reestablishment of Israel, pioneering spirit of Israel, the hope that this represents for mankind. All of these themes are freely and easily spoken here as they were not in the earlier text. In other words, it's the text of a book of a people who are happy with their sense of belonging, who are at ease with being Jewish, but who have not yet made up their mind in what being Jewish consists. And that, I submit to you, is a clear statement of the status of American Jewry today. We know we are Jewish. We participate easily in any number of activities which are openly and clearly labeled Jewish. We involve ourselves with agencies which are Jewish in their orientation. We carry the label easily. We participate often in the rituals of our people. But two things, to a large degree, are missing. And that is, we haven't yet defined collectively what we mean by a Jewish identity, Jewish values, a Jewish philosophy. We're not clear on that. We vaguely think it means to be good, to be just, to be kind. But how specifically, that we haven't defined. And we have not also come to minds theologically with what it means to be Jewish. What affirmations do we make about God? What is it we're really saying when we affirm a God? So are we affirming a sugar daddy in heaven? Are we affirming the moral purpose of the universe? Are we affirming a God who has certain attributes after which we must try to shape our lives, to imitate in our lives? The eclecticism, the diversity of this book makes it very difficult for anyone to argue with it, because you can find within it everything. Humanism, theism, monotheism, naturalism. You can find within it affirmation of a personal God. You'll find within it that immortality is an achievement of our own memories, of our own activities. You're going to the promise of immortality as part of the universe. You can find in it even an affirmation of the resurrection of the dead. Almost everything was put into this book because the problems of judgment, the creation of a philosophy of American Judaism, has not yet been resolved. This is a book for Amcha, for people. It's a book for people in a search. Every congregation will use from this book what it wants to emphasize. But it will not do what the old Union Prayer Book did, which was to create a synthesis. That is, to speak the synthesis, the philosophy of a time that was appropriate to that time. And what you'll find because of the variety of this text is not only will a service sound different, be staged differently in various synagogues, because there's so much choice, there's so many ways to do it. But you also find that different synagogues will be, in a sense, sending out a different message. And here the medium is the message. They'll be sending out a different message as to the meaning of Jewish life. That's inevitable, given the heterogeneity of our congregations, given the lack of clear definition within the movement. But if I were to make a prediction, my prediction would be that by the time another Union Prayer Book, the new Union Prayer Book, is finally edited, we will have had to come to some resolution of these unresolved questions, if the movement itself will have progressed, if it will have meaning and bite, if it will really be able to command respect by insisting on a certain set of principles which it believes are firm and true and must somehow be propagated. Having said all of that, why are we going to make more use of this prayer book? Well, for many reasons. First of all, it's new. Second of all, as part of movement, we want our young people particularly to be able to move from place to place and feel somewhat at home. The Union Prayer Book is going out of style. This book is coming in style. It has the great advantage of having no more THs and none of those hard lisping sounds that gave so many of us so much trouble. From some of us, it's going to give us a lot of trouble. When I read this new prayer book, I find myself having the same problem I had 20 years ago when I had to switch from Ashkenazic Hebrew to Sephardic Hebrew, and I found myself speaking Ashko-Sephard, which was kind of a mishmash, a combination of all. The language is so similar in parts that I find myself instinctively repeating the language which is part of my heart, and often not even looking at the text, and then all of a sudden I look down and I'm a little startled that the words have slightly reshaped. I'm also convinced that it will help us in one major respect, and that is the respect of becoming a singing congregation. I keep coming back to this theme. It's the great frustration, as you know, of my life. You're wonderful people. The rabbi couldn't ask for a nicer congregation, but you're the most silent congregation in America. Now, I don't believe it's because you can't sing. I can't sing, but you can. And to me, the great advantage of this new prayer book is are the 70 songs which are bound within it. Some of you may remember the old Union hymnal, which we had 30, 40 years ago, which had the music and the songs. We did a little better then. But when we had no more hymnal, and only the Union Prayer Book, there was nothing to say, now let's try and end the service with Adon Olam, or some other one of the familiar hymns. These now are here. And I give you fair warning, my friends, that from time I'm going to ask you to join from time to time in singing these hymns with us, and please be in cooperative voice. It's a good book. It has its weaknesses. I was on the committee originally, which was brought into being by the conference to create a new prayer book. I lasted one session. I made one suggestion, and remain sorry they didn't act on it. I felt that after the rabbis had agreed as to what ought to be in the book theologically and had tried to write the material, we ought to get the finest English stylist in America to come along behind and turn the English into fine prose. They didn't do it. The man who had been hired to put together the prayer book was a man of many talents,
was mortally offended by my suggestion. It was not a personal attack on him at all. But much of the English reminds me of a college freshman's theme rather than a finely shaped and sculpted English. And I think that as the book is used over time and when it comes to a new printing, there will be reason to reshape, resculpt some of the language so that it is a little more literate, a little more biting, a little more pointed than it is now. But that too says something about our times. We use a lot of words to say what we could say in a few words. You know what I mean? This is a you know what I mean book in a sense. English is the English of those who have not yet mastered English. It's fascinating, isn't it? Our grandparents' generation, the immigrant generation, spoke the King's English, and we speak street. And there's a certain amount of street, I'm afraid, in this text. Well, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, the proof of a prayer book is in the using, and you will be able to carry this heavy book on your lap more often in the months that lie ahead as we get used to it together. And now we continue using our text by turning. This is the other problem with the book, by the way. There are too many stage directions that have to be given. I have a feeling that we're going to end up having a bulletin board up here, as they had in the old congregational churches in New England, you know, with a list of the hymns for the service of the morning, which will tell you what page to turn to. But in any case, 615, and we rise for the Alleluia.